This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
A massive leak of documents has blown open a window on the vast, murky world of shell companies, providing an extraordinary look at how the wealthy and powerful conceal their money. The data breach occurred at a little-known but powerful Panamanian law firm, Mossack Fonseca, which has an office in Las Vegas, a representative in Miami, and a presence in more than 35 other places around the world. The firm is one of the world's top five creators of shell companies, which can have legitimate business uses, but can also be used to dodge taxes and launder money. We're joined by James Henry, who has written extensively about global banking, debt crises, tax havens, and economic development. And Henry is former chief economist at the international consultancy firm McKinsey & Company, and now is a senior fellow at the Columbia University Center for Sustainable International Investment and senior advisor with the Tax Justice Network. And they've done this study that says it's called The Price of Offshore Revisited, and they've estimated that total wealth in tax havens was between $21 trillion and $32 trillion. Hey, we're talking about a lot. James Henry's books include The Blood Bankers, Tales from the Global Underground Economy, and his forthcoming book, which we'll have him back to discuss, The Pirate Bankers. And thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you.
So talk about when you first came across Mossack Fonseca while in Panama, which I understand was while you were investigating the assassination of the health minister there during the Noriega government in the 1980s.
That's right. I mean, I had been in the corporate sector. I went and got a book contract after I wrote an article about capital flight pouring out of Latin America into Citibank and other banks. And I was in Panama investigating not only that case, but also the question of the general's involvement in drug traffic. And at that time, it was about 1987. Noriega was still in power, probably not a wise thing to do. But so I was running around Panama, and I came across this law firm because they were already recognized as one of the edgiest law firms. This is, 40 years ago. So of course, Noriega was then removed from power 3 years later. Some of the data I found was used in his trial. I came across all his international phone calls. But, the point is that this law firm was well known. Certainly the U.S. government knew all about it way back when. And this behavior is very old. It's been going on for a long time. And the global haven industry that surrounds this law firm and actually enables it has grown exponentially since then. So we sort of missed an opportunity to crack down on this kind of behavior, and now we have this global network, not just serving one dictator, but this law firm has been serving kleptocrats all over the planet. Last count, more than 140 sitting public officials have been turned up in these files.
Well, it was interesting. It was announced that the Icelandic Prime Minister resigned. There's implications of Marie Le Pen, the ultra-far-right group in France, as involved. There are also issues of numerous other entities. Tell us how extensive this is and really what it is that people should care about. I understand there's also investigations now as a result of the leak of what's being called the Panama Papers. There's investigations in Spain and France, et cetera. So give us a sense of the breadth and the importance of this particular issue.
Well, I would say that, first of all, that none of this behavior is necessarily illegal. That's a judicial determination. Journalists are not prosecutors. But we have produced, I'd say, a lot of smoke here that prosecutors all over the planet ought to be interested in. I mean, when you have the president of the Ukraine having a company that's holding offshore assets that he claimed he had sold all of his assets when he became president. You have a president of Argentina whose father and brother turned up as owning Mossack companies. Ex-president Lula of Brazil, his house was owned through a company that derived from this. this is not just a bad apple in Panama either. You have 15,000 of these companies were formed at the behest of major banks around the planet, like HSBC, more than 2,300 companies, UBS, Credit Suisse. So what you have to imagine here, the most important point about this is that this is kind of a seamless global industry. And you have big banks like the ones I've mentioned and others channeling business to entities like Mossack. Mossack is not alone in this. There's at least a half dozen other companies, law firms and corporate registries that do similar kind of registration of companies in offshore havens. What basically they're selling is financial secrecy. I mean, nobody's putting their money in Panama. The money all comes back to Western markets, you know, New York, London, Zurich. But it's basically what Panama is doing is providing anonymity. You can set up a shell company or a trust by way of this law firm. And, you know, they have 35 jurisdictions where they're present. So most of their companies came from a British overseas territory called BVI, where there's more than a million companies registered today. You know, nobody has to declare who owns these companies. The so-called beneficial owners are secret, similarly for trusts. And so this sets up a situation in which people, we now have all these public officials, but also wealthy individuals, people who want to dodge taxes. You know, there's just all this chicanery that is facilitated by financial secrecy. And so the real issue is, how do you get at this kind of financial secrecy?
And, you know, some of the, if you could break out just, and we'll get back to that question, some of the allegations against you have Russian President Vladimir Putin and Syrian President Bashar al-Assad through their associates that are reported, and you certainly mentioned the Ukrainian president Petro Poroshenko and Argentina's president, who the President Obama just visited, et cetera.
Right. Yeah, and you have the prime minister of China's brother-in-law owns two of these companies. You know, Putin's not implicated directly, but two of his longest standing childhood friends have been channeling at least up to $2 billion through on companies. The prime minister of Pakistan has three offshore accounts by way of this law firm. It's kind of funny that the prime minister of Pakistan somehow found his way to, or Putin's inner circle found their way to Panama. But that's the way this network business works. They're not operating alone. What you have to imagine is really a global industry that is working across borders and across havens to set up these complicated structures. And, you know, there's also an important onshore haven industry. We have Delaware, the state of Delaware. There's nearly a million companies in Delaware. Nobody knows who owns them because we don't have beneficial ownership registration either. So one of the demands that the tax justice movement and many other NGOs have been making is to have public registries of who owns what. You know, and when I started working in this area in the 1980s, the BVI had about 3,000 offshore companies. Today they have more than a million. Activity has exploded. It facilitates all kinds of, I mean, if you imagine the Star Wars bar scene, where you have over in one corner the drug dealers and then the tax dodgers, the kleptocrats, you know, people engaged in insider trading or credit fraud or, you know, trying to set up special purpose vehicles to facilitate lousy lending in the U.S., as we saw in 2008. This is, you know, all these folks are sitting around the same basic facility, which is called financial secrecy. And that's what's grown up here, this seamless network of banks and law firms and accounting firms that are facilitating all this.
So we're back in your bar in Star Wars, and with every conceivable tool to facilitate kleptocrats, where is offered there. So we're talking about really theft of public assets, concealing bribes, financial fraud, corruption, irresponsible finance. Is that the story?
Well, I think, you know, in this aspect, we've seen more than before in terms of the so-called kleptocracy. if you're the dictator in Angola, you know, Dos Santos, you don't care, and you've stolen billions of dollars. All you want to do is keep the pile. You're not interested in the yield on the assets or the investment, or you're not interested in evading taxes. There is no tax levied by many developing countries effectively. The real issue is kleptocracy and public officials able to abuse their offices, helping themselves to the treasury or accepting secret bribes and then, you know, biasing their policies. This is a whole phenomenon with the, you know, 140 heads of state or senior officials or former officials. This is coming front and center in this scandal. And the fact that you have some of the biggest banks channeling this kind of business, I mean, this Panamanian law firm did not send people, retail salespeople, to call on President Putin. They only existed by way of references from this global network. So it really is a network that has to be dealt with. The other thing I would say is that it's not just about I mean, we've had revelations like this each and every decade for the last 40 years since the industry took off. And, you know, time and again, governments have basically failed to do anything about it. This is by far the biggest leak ever. But if you had a single Swiss bank have a similar kind of whistleblower, it would dwarf by a long shot the impact of this particular Panamanian law firm. So, you know, we still have a lot of work to do to clean this up. And, you know, I think the onus is on governments. Obama made a statement yesterday about finally getting around to doing something about this. But the fact is that even under a Democratic administration in the United States, we've had a head of the IRS chief legal counsel who was a former registered representative for the Swiss Bankers Association. We've had, the United States refusing to go along with the OECD's recommendation that we have beneficial ownership, public registration of companies and trusts in the United States. There's a lot of work that we have to do politically here, and I think Bernie Sanders has glommed onto this. You know, it's just outrageous that the world's wealthiest people, we're talking about the 21 to 32 trillion as of the end of 2010, that we identified as offshore assets, basically owned by the world's 0.14% of the population. So, a tiny fraction of people, maybe 10 million people on the planet, top 100,000 own about a third of it. So we're talking about a very small number of people who are relatively benefiting from this haven secrecy.
And we should mention, or you should mention, what you pointed out off air, the incredible hypocrisy, for example, of somebody like David Cameron, who's been talking about cleaning up offshore havens. But,
well, it turns out his father, who died in 2010, was a director of a fund that had been set up with the help of Mossack Fonseca in the Bahamas. And it was explicitly designed to help wealthy Brits avoid minimize taxes. Again, nothing necessarily legal about that, but it got a question in Parliament yesterday from Jeremy Corbyn, who said, you know, did you have any income from the trusts that your father left you? And Cameron's the Prime Minister of England, has 3 years ago, he promised to clean up financial secrecy, and he has a big conference coming up in May in London on corruption. So this strikes right at the question of whether he's really willing to do anything about it. The UK has changed its public registration of offshore trusts and companies, but there are these entities like the British Virgin Islands and Cayman Islands are British overseas territories, and they have refused to have this kind of reform. So they're still abusing the system, and BVI was the place that this Panamanian law firm had half of its companies. So this is a major case of hypocrisy. The West is basically, in a way, it's not surprising. Nobody wants to keep their money in Panama. The money is flowing back to the Western markets, as I said before. So you know, U.S. banks traditionally have gotten a lot of money out of Latin America, capital flight pouring into U.S. banks and investments. A lot of that money is by way of our tax laws. If you're a non-resident alien and you come from Latin America, you're not, for example, here more than about 180 days a year as a living in the United States, you are tax-free on all of your income from capital. And so we have acted as a kind of tax haven. And this isn't unusual or unique to the United States. The UK has similar arrangements for so-called non-DOMs. There's more than 90,000 Russian people living in Moscow on the Thames, they call it. You know, so most European countries have similar arrangements for offshore capital, people who want to live tax-free. So you have this emerging class of people who are citizens of nowhere for tax purposes. You know, it's just outrageous.
So you're saying, really, that the poor countries in particular suffer from these tax havens, et cetera, that go back to certainly the 70s and 80s, the use of the drug money and big Western banks participating in all these dodgy third world lending. So these banks, if I got it right, would lend to despots in poor countries, knowing the money would end up going back to them, not helping the people. Is that part of this
incredible
shell game?
The first story I wrote about this was a cover story for the New Republic, in which I exposed the fact that Citibank had been, which was supposedly the largest lender to Latin America in the 1980s, had actually taken more money out by way of its rather secretive international private banking department than it had loaned to all of Latin America. This is as of 1986. And since then, the business has really exploded. When I went to the Philippines to look at where Marcos made, Ferdinand Marcos, who was dictator from 73 to 86 in the Philippines, where he made his fortune, you know, it wasn't just bribery or local corruption. He had managed to take hold of the central bank of the Philippines and was using it as a piggy bank, and they borrowed more than $7 billion and channeled it directly offshore. The Philippines kept servicing those debts, but the money ended up in UBS and Credit Suisse. You know, it was basically in private bank accounts or holding companies that the Marcos family and their cronies own. So that's a case of a direct kind of round-trip deal, very early kind of chicanery in this area. But that's an example of how this, you know, the banking industry has really been deeply involved in facilitating the growth of the global haven industry. A lot of the companies that we've seen, more than 15,000 of the 214,000 Mossack Fonseca companies, offshore companies, were set up directly by banks. UBS set up about 1,100 of them, Credit Suisse about 1,100, HSBC, the one time the largest bank in the world, set up 2,300 that we've been able to find so far. So, you know, this is outrageous. And for these, all of these deeply, these major financial institutions, you know, were deeply involved in the financial crisis. They all got bailed out in 2008 with taxpayer money. So for them to be facilitating tax dodging and kleptocracy on a massive scale, you know, that's kind of the real problem at the heart of the story.
So all of this undermines the international taxation and the rule of law. This network of institutions selling secrecy undermines the whole political system. So what do? You fight for progressive taxation? Is that the response to this latest revelation that has been issued and will continue to issue documents, the McClatchy News Network, what's being called the Panama Papers? What is this?
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of work to do here. First of all, we do need technical reforms like the beneficial ownership registration, but we need much tougher enforcement. And we have to have these institutions that are behind all this, that are working seamlessly across borders, actually be regulated across borders. So there has to be much tougher enforcement and more cooperation across countries. You know, they basically have a, we have a thing called tax competition. You know, as recently as last week, I was in Washington talking to folks, and there were people defending the idea of the U.S. as a tax haven. We ought to be cutting our taxes and attracting foreign money here. Well, that's just a fool's game. You know, that's a race to the bottom. We've been cutting taxes year in, year out since the 1980s under Reagan, corporate and income tax rates. If you look at the average rates, have been coming down again and again. The United States cuts its corporate tax rate. You know, the effective tax rate that, that companies are able to pay is a lot lower than the 35%. I mean, Apple's paying 1% on their offshore income, which is about 60% of their global income, because they're parking companies in Ireland and Netherlands and Bermuda and paying themselves royalties on intellectual property that they transfer there and paying, you know, virtually no tax at all. So the tax competition game where U.S. cuts its tax rates and then Canada responds and the U.K. responds, and, you know, we end up in a race to the bottom. That's one basic problem here, this lack of coordinated cooperation across countries. So tax cooperation has to replace tax competition. But in this area of kleptocracy, I think we need basic rules like government officials should have to declare their offshore wealth, their onshore wealth, and their incomes, and let us know if they're going to be in office, they have to release their tax returns. You know, I think that would be one basic demand. I would love to see Donald Trump's tax returns. I think, you know, that's a basic element in this. I think, you know, we just need much more disclosure to shine light on this behavior. And then we need, you know, both parties to start getting serious about regulating big banks, because at the core of this is the kind of too fail, big to fail fact, too big to jail. In the last 5 years, we've had the Justice Department under Obama prosecuting banks like UBS and HSBC and Credit Suisse, the same guys involved in this scandal up to their eyebrows, for helping wealthy Americans take money offshore. You know, at the same time, our own banks are welcoming this kind of dodgy money by way of conduit companies from law firms like Mossack Fonseca. So if you're a wealthy Mexican and you have a BDI company and it shows up in Citibank, Citibank doesn't have to worry about whether you're actually ripping off anybody in Mexico. There's no reporting. You know, you're fine. You're actually just a BVI company. You don't show up as a wealthy individual from a Latin American country. So that kind of hypocrisy and, you know, double standard is really also at stake here. So I mean, I really think we need more of a bipartisan approach to this. You know, I was on CNBC a while ago, and one of the conservative announcers there said, well, you know, what's wrong with tax havens? And I said, well, basically, this is about the rule of law. You know, if you have leading government officials around the planet able to put their wealth offshore, you have major wealthy people able to put their money in havens and avoid taxes completely, you know, it's going to undermine democracy. Ultimately, going to transfer the tax burden to the middle class and the poor. I mean, and nobody likes to pay taxes, but the point is that there's an irreducible kind of 30% of GDP that has to be paid to support schools and hospitals and, you know, national security and roads and all the other things that government pays for. You know, we've tried privatization. We have tried deficit finance. We've tried, you know, inflation finance. You know, at the end of the day, in order to be a developed country, you have to spend about a third of GDP on government. And if the poor and the middle class is going to have to pay for all of that, and the rich are going to be able to move their money abroad, it just becomes intolerable. We're going back to the Middle Ages, where you had the nobility basically being tax-free and the peasants having to pay the whole cost of government.
Well, James Henry, we're going to have to leave it there, but I insist that you come back with your forthcoming book, The Pirate Bankers. These are things that can't make us glaze over. We've got to get more enmeshed in this, and we've got to flesh out much greater details than even Bernie Sanders, who has certainly tackled the issue of the onerous nature of the big banks. There are still a whole lot more flesh to be put on those bones, and you helped us do some of that this morning. We really want to thank you for spending the time. And again, we have been speaking with James Henry, whose forthcoming book is The Pirate Bankers. You'll come back and talk to us about that?
Delighted, yeah.
Thanks.
And
yeah.
Good. Stay tuned. This, there's more, much more to come here.
Well, we insist that you come back and help us unravel these pieces that will be coming out as part of the Panama Papers expose. Thank you, James.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.